In August, I preached a sermon on tectonic shifts in the global religious landscape on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I. And 100 years later, we see, for example, that the end of the Ottoman Empire in the aftermath of World War I, and with it, the effective end of the Islamic Caliphate, radically affected Islam. In the words of historian Philip Jenkins, as a political force, Islam in 1914 was inconceivably weaker than today. There were perhaps 240 million Muslims in the world, so that Christians outnumbered Muslims 2-1, compared to a modern ratio of closer to 1.5. The number of Muslims alive in 1914 was not much larger than the Muslim population today of Indonesia alone. And as I promised, I said I would pick up there in a forthcoming sermon about the future of Islam in October, and here we are. And that historical note about the end of the Islamic Caliphate in the wake of the First World War seems even more relevant now with the terrorist group ISIS making headlines with horrific acts of savagery in an effort to reestablish what they envision as a new Islamic Caliphate. And that word caliphate is from the Arabic word for succession. So it's a caliphate is an Islamic empire ruled by a supreme religious and political leader known as a caliph who sees himself, usually himself, not herself, as a successor to Muhammad. But long before ISIS started making headlines, I planned to preach this Sunday about Islam. Because as we gather here in this sanctuary, more than 2 million Muslims are gathered and nearing the end of the annual week-long pilgrimage to the city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia, known as the Hajj. And Hajj is nothing more than the Arabic word for pilgrimage. Any pilgrimage is a Hajj, but Hajj has come to refer specifically to that annual pilgrimage to Mecca. And Hajj is, of course, one of the five pillars of Islam. Muslims are expected to make Hajj at least once in a lifetime if they're able to, financially and physically. There's an old saying that the difference between a pilgrim and a tourist is that a tourist just passes through a place, but a pilgrim allows a place to pass through them. And Muslims who have completed the Hajj report feeling more connected to the sacred, to their own deepest selves, and to the worldwide Muslim community known as the Ummah. The other four pillars of Islam are the Shahada, testimony, Salat, prayer, Ramadan, that month-long fast, and Zakat, almsgiving. The Shahada, so as opposed to like, if you think of like the Nicene Creed, it's a very long creed that some Orthodox Christians memorize and recite. The Shahada is one single sentence about monotheism and belief in the trustworthiness of what the Prophet Muhammad taught about the one God. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is the prophet, the messenger of God. And you may notice that I said God and not Allah, and that's because Allah is just the Arabic word for God. If you're an Arabic Christian or an Arabic Jew talking about God or praying to God, you too would use the word Allah. It's just the Arabic word for God. Muslims are also called to pray 5 times per day at sunrise, noon, mid-afternoon, sunset, and evening. To fast from dawn to dusk each day during the month of Ramadan, refraining from food, drink, smoking, sex, and anger. And to give 2.5% not of income, but of wealth, 2.5% of wealth annually to charity. From a Unitarian Universalist perspective, the most significant aspect of the five pillars of Islam is they make Islam what is known as an orthopraxy, that is, a religion concerned with right action, not an orthodoxy, a religion concerned with right belief. Unitarian Universalism is also an orthopraxy. We believe in deeds, not creeds, and that religion is much more about ethics than about believing 6 impossible things before breakfast, as the White Queen told Alice she sometimes tries to do. So one important piece of hope for the future of Islam is focusing this ethical framework of the five pillars that is at the core of Islam, is increasingly focusing that on social justice, as well as supporting those who are taking bold stances of reinterpreting traditional Islam through the lens of science, democracy, and human rights. But I invite you to consider that the future of Islam is not merely about how we think we want Islam to change. Rather, we should also consider how Islam might inform the future of Unitarian Universalism. What might we learn, for example, from the five pillars of Islam, from the way they do orthopraxy? Well, what if once in a lifetime, all Unitarian Universalists who were able, physically and financially, were encouraged to make a pilgrimage to Unitarian Universalist historical sites? Like, what would our Mecca be? Boston, right? So there's the old 19th century joke that Unitarianism is about the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the neighborhood of Boston. Or what about a pilgrimage to the many sites in Concord related to the 19th century Transcendentalist movement? Or making pilgrimage to Transylvania to explore the 16th century European roots of Unitarianism? Or to Murray Grove on the New Jersey shore, where John Murray, the founder of American Universalism, first preached Universalism in 1770? How might your Unitarian Universalism be transformed, not by passing through those places as a tourist, but by allowing those places and what happened there to pass through you, similar to what 2 million Muslims are doing right now in Mecca? Relatedly, how might Unitarian Universalism be strengthened if all you use paused 5 times every day to do the spiritual practice of your choice? 5 times a day. Or spent 1 month. What if we each spent 1 month of the year, the month of your choice, 30 days, intensively practicing whatever spiritual path you choose? Or what if all you use annually contributed 2.5% of their wealth, not just their income? As you can likely guess, though, most Americans are not sitting up at night with the burning question, what can I learn from Islam? Rather, 57% of Americans, so well into a majority of Americans, when asked, what do you admire most about Muslim societies, say either nothing or I don't know. Years after 9/11, nearly two-thirds of Americans confess that they do not have even the most basic understanding about Islam, what Muslims do, who they are, what they believe. And in light of such ignorance, 4 years ago, when a fundamentalist Christian minister received an incredibly irresponsible amount of media attention for his offensive, self-declared International Burn a Quran Day, as his way of, this is what we should do to religiously commemorate 9/11. That was his idea. I joined with many of my theologically progressive colleagues in changing the sermon that I had planned for that Sunday and preached instead on International Read a Quran Day. And although the First Amendment can be read as protecting the right of any individual or group to burn any book that they so choose, I feel called, and as do many Unitarian Universalists, to use that same freedom of speech, to use that same freedom of religion, to discourage acts of division, violence, and hate, and to instead model a more compassionate, inclusive, and healthy way of being religious, as we seek to do here in this place. And to place Islamophobic acts such as International Burn a Quran Day in their historical perspective, it's important to remember that the way Islam is perceived here in the West, especially after 9/11, is vastly different than the past, vastly different than 100 years ago, with the beginning of after the end of World War I, and really for decades after that. For most of the 20th century, almost no one in the West was focusing on Islam. Our government wasn't focused on Islam. Our media wasn't focused on Islam. Academics were not focused on Islam. And then the Iranian Revolution happened. In 1979, the world looked on in stunned disbelief as an aged Ayatollah living in exile in the suburbs of Paris led a revolution that overthrew one of the most powerful rulers in the Middle East. In my own study of Islam, the scholar I have found to be most helpful is John Esposito, a longtime professor of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. Esposito is actually a Roman Catholic. He's from an Italian family. He grew up in Brooklyn. He spent 10 years in a monastery before going to Temple University and getting a PhD in Islamic studies. But what's important is that he did that in 1974, 5 years before the Islamic Revolution. I had the opportunity to hear Esposito deliver the President's Address when the American Academy of Religion was in Baltimore last November. For anyone interested, I'll post a link to that, the full transcript of that address, in the manuscript version of this sermon that we'll put on our website sermon archive. It's very much worth reading. But my point is that it was fascinating to hear Esposito speak about the evolution of Islam in the West that he's seen in his academic career. You know, his academic career has gone from 74, when nobody was studying Islam, through the Iranian Revolution, and he's been was really a senior, widely respected Islamic scholar in 9/11 and in the aftermath. So my sermon title is also a direct allusion to his 2010 book with Oxford University Press called The Future of Islam. And if the sermon leaves you curious to learn more, that's a good next step to go to. And in considering the future of Islam, perhaps the most important piece of data to keep in mind is demographics. Remember there were 240 million Muslims in 1914, about the same as just in Indonesia today. There are now 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide and about 2.1 billion Christians. So that 1.5 billion makes Islam the second largest religion in the world. And although terrorist groups who claim to speak for all Muslims must be dealt with seriously, extremists are not representative of the vast majority of Muslims. Indeed, not only are overwhelming numbers of Muslims not terrorists or terrorist sympathizers, but also, contrary to popular stereotypes, most Muslims aren't Arab. Does anybody know about how many Muslims, what percentage of Muslims are Arabs? Any guesses? 17%? 20%. One in five Muslims are Arab. And the countries with the largest Muslim populations, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, Nigeria, they're all democracies. So, you know, going against that stereotype that Islam is incompatible with democracy. In the words of a religion professor from American University in D.C., Saudi Arabia has only the 16th largest Muslim population in the world, behind countries such as Uzbekistan, Ethiopia, Turkey, and Iran. For what it's worth, Saudi Arabia's Muslim population is about roughly equivalent to the Muslim population of China. All of this should make us reconsider how we perceive not only Islam, but also the locus of its power and influence. While the Saudi government routinely casts itself as the protector and defender of the faith, they represent, in fact, only a small fraction of the world's Muslims. So the huge number of Muslims outside the Middle East show both the diversity of Islam in the present as well as a hope for an increasingly open and pluralistic Islam in the future. Tragically, however, both ignorance and Islamophobia in our country has caused our country in recent years to do as much harm as good in laying the groundwork for a hopeful future for Islam. Abuses in Iraq, Abu Ghraib, as well as Guantanamo Bay and the rendition of prisoners in countries employing harsh interrogation techniques and torture, undermine the U.S. record of human rights and outrage not only Muslims, but rightly many around the world. U.S. foreign policy also undermines the future of Islam and our future on this planet when we embrace the doctrines of preemptive strikes, when we sidestep the Geneva Accords, and when we try to exempt ourselves from any sort of international accountability. Conversely, perhaps the single best way that we can contribute to securing a hopeful future for Islam and for our world is by supporting and funding the education of women everywhere around the globe. And to inverse our perspective further, what if we ask not what Americans say about Muslims out of their ignorance, but what Muslims say about us and what they say about themselves? The best starting point I've found for the former is a book published in 2007. Esposito was one of the editors, titled Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, based on the Gallup's World Poll, the largest study of its kind. As a counterpoint to the majority of Americans who say there is nothing they admire about Muslim societies, Muslims say, well, let me tell you what we admire least about the West. Here are three of the highlights. They say, your 18-year-olds are independent and can make any decision they want. Parents seemingly have no importance after that point, and they misbehave with their parents. They are vulgar, and they have no respect for elders. They have weak family bonds, and they don't seem to care about other people's feelings. And if you want to hear Muslims speaking for themselves about Islam, one of the most fascinating places that I've found to listen is actually on Twitter. How many of you are on Twitter? All right, a few. All right, we can talk afterwards if you're curious about how to get on Twitter. I particularly recommend the hashtags NotYourStockMuslim and MuslimApologies. Here are just a few examples. We come from different backgrounds. We have different experiences. We cannot be homogenized into one voice. Not your stock Muslim. Angry terrorist number 3, brown taxi cab driver, and Slumdog Millionaire's second stunt double aren't on my LinkedIn profile. Not your stock Muslims. My aspiration in life is not to look more like Princess Jasmine. Not your stock Muslim. Both East and West Indian, in a sorority, active in public health activism and reproductive justice movements. Not your stock Muslim. My parents were the first people to expose me to feminism. Not your stock Muslim. Both my younger sisters who practice hijab are on their high school sports team, basketball and gymnastics. Not your stock Muslim. Lefty feminist Muslim. Fave memory, bringing home agnostic white boy. My Muslim father was the first to step up and support. Not your stock Muslim. I met my husband through the traditional Desi marriage process. I chose this. 11 years and 2 kids later, never happier. Not your stock Muslim. We're not 2D characters who either pray and hate the West or drink alcohol and hate the West. Not your stock Muslim. Investment counselor who wears pantsuits with her hijab to work because she's not your stock Muslim, except when she's trading stocks. I'm sorry you tapped my phone and all you learned was that I was planning a potluck at the mosque on Friday. Muslim apologies. I'm sorry I don't know how to use an AK-47. Muslim apologies. And I'm sorry that you tripped while staring at me. Muslim apologies. These are just a small sample of 21st century Muslim voices that give me hope about the future of Islam. So what causes the opposite, extremist voices to emerge? Studies by the European Network of Experts on Violent Radicalization, that's another panel that Esposito, as well as many other Muslim experts, are on, the Network on Global Terrorism and Suicide Bombing, have found that in most cases, religion is not the primary source of extremist behavior. In fact, most terrorists are neither particularly religiously literate or particularly religiously observant. Drivers of radicalization include moral outrage, disaffection, peer pressure, the search for a new identity, and for a sense of meaning, purpose, and belonging. Said differently, it's unemployed young men who society hasn't properly supported. Polls show that a majority of Muslims worldwide want the same things that we in the West and that humans generally want. They say on polls what they want most are improved economic conditions, jobs, improved living standards, law and order they can trust, democratic ideals, eliminating civil tensions and war, enhancing respect and independence for their countries, eradicating illiteracy and ignorance, achieving gender equity, social justice, and religious freedom. For me, the takeaway is that decreasing wealth inequality and creating more opportunity, educating the public about the diversity of the world's 1.7 billion Muslims and supporting the education of women across the globe are all the major steps that we can take if we really do want a hopeful future for Islam and for this planet. May we each do our part in bringing about such a future with hope.